danger is stealing in as relapse hums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 214 of the Thinking Poker Podcast from Owings Mills, Maryland. I'm Andrew Brookes, joined by Nate Mavis in Melrose, Massachusetts. How's it going, Nate?
Wonderful. How are you?
I'm also good, and we're in a little bit of a time crunch for our introduction here, so let's just roll right along. Our guest tonight is Daniel Wolf, a lot of nicknames, as we'll discuss on the show. But yeah, Daniel Wolf is his given name. And he's someone who I've played a bit with in Pittsburgh and in Maryland. You might have seen him on Poker Night in America. But this is one of these interviews where it's like, you know, someone that one of us knows vaguely and would like to get to know a little bit better. And the person was willing to come on the show, and here we are. And I think it turned into a pretty entertaining conversation. He's an entertaining guy to play poker with, and he was an entertaining guy to interview.
I agree. It was a pleasure to meet him.
And so the beginning of the interview, Nate was stuck in traffic, so he'll join. You'll hear when he comes on. But about the first 15 minutes or so of the interview, it's just me and Daniel, so don't be thrown by that. Let's see, intro stuff. I've got coming up this week. I think I mentioned this on last week's show, but by the time this airs, I will have played and hopefully won the World Series of Poker Circuit event at the Horseshoe in Baltimore, which this is actually the first time. I mean, this casino in downtown Baltimore has been open for a couple years. I went there opening weekend. I like the place. I mean, it's a more comfortable room, I think, than Maryland Live. The food is much better than what's available at Maryland Live, but they've just haven't really had big games. So I've never been back since opening weekend, so I'm happy to have an excuse to go down there.
Yeah, good luck. I'll be rooting for you, certainly. And and that sound you hear is my dog Raylan making his podcast debut. He's just wandered into my office here. So
yeah, the cat used to or cat or cats?
Cat, just cat. One.
The cat has been on, and yeah, welcome Raylan.
Yeah, well, he's what he would really like is to get food, but he'll have to settle for making his podcast debut.
It is nearly World Series of Poker time, and what better way to get geared up for the World Series of Poker than watching a hand history review from either Nate Mavis or myself? You can find both on tournamentpokeredge.com. There are video series from Nate and from me going hand by hand. Well, I guess not every single hand that we played, but many hands that we played during the World Series of Poker main event. And, of course, plenty of other poker tournament strategy as well. All of it available for as little as $25 a month at tournamentpokeredge.com. Would it be ambitious to try to talk about this PLO hand that I emailed you?
Yeah, let's give it a shot.
Okay. So I found myself playing in a 5-5-10 game at, this is appropriate, so you know, we'll talk to Daniel about the Rivers Poker Room in Pittsburgh, and I actually was just back in Pittsburgh last weekend. I used to live there. I lived there for 2 years. I played regularly at Rivers, and I kind of wanted just to stop by Rivers for old time's sake as much as anything, but you know, of course, I brought money with me. As it happened, there was a 5-5-10 PLO game going, and a seat opened up in it, and I said, what the hell? I don't really know how to play. Well, I mean, I know how to play PLO, but I'm not that great at it, but it looked like a good lineup. I was like, I can probably be competitive with these guys out there, and I did. And yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, my first strategic comment is good for you. Play poker to make money. If the money is in that game, if that's where you're going to be, you got to suck it up and be willing to, you know, have a smaller edge than you would have in a no limit game against the same players, but realize that you can only play in games that exist, and this game exists.
Yeah, that was. I mean, there was only like the biggest no limit game. It was 2-5, so you know, I really couldn't play a high stakes game unless I played the PLO. Yep. And this game, there was it was an uncapped buy-in. I felt like, you know, the $1,000 was the minimum. I kind of felt like $2,000 might be the sort of smallest socially acceptable amount to buy in for. And I don't, like, I have no problem with people buying in for the minimum, but just as a professional, I don't want to walk into a game and be ruining it for recreational players if they want to be playing deep. So I just think that's sort of like poor ethics. I mean, the better decision for me might well have been to kind of short stack this game, but $2,000 was still short. Like, that was still a lot less money than many people had on the table.
Sure.
But I mean, for me, that was like, I don't need to be in a PLO hand 500 big blinds deep out of position. As you'll see, I'm relatively lost, even, you know, being 300 big blinds deep out of position.
Yep.
So this hand occurred, and I got the sense that this game is sort of full of, you know, I think a lot of amateur players, but people who play in the game pretty regularly, and so have at least learned how to avoid like the most obvious PLO mistakes, which I don't necessarily, I mean, I have kind of have a sense of what they are, but I know, I mean, I think in many cases these players will have better instincts than I will about sort of what to avoid. And then there's a few, I think, you know, pretty good players whose game is maybe optimized for playing in a game like this, where they're playing more hands and they could get away with playing, I imagine, against a tough field. But if they're playing with a field of players who don't play super well after the flop and don't 3-bet very often, they can get away with playing a lot of these hands and with raising more than they probably should in early position. That was the sense that I got anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So this hand comes up, and the player on my immediate left is one of these players who, he seems like one of the better players in the game, but is just in a lot of pots and showing down some hands that, as best I can tell, are pretty janky. So this is a 5-5 game with a $10 button straddle, which means the blinds are acting first, and I'm the big blind in this hand. The small blind calls, and I have ace, king, queen, 10 double suited in the big blind. I think it's extremely likely, I mean, probably like 70% there's going to be a raise if I just complete. We didn't have a lot of limp pots going to the flop. And I also think this is not a terrible hand to take to the flop in a limp pot if that's going to happen. So I figured I would limp here, looking to get in a limp re-raise. Does that seem reasonable?
Yeah, sounds really good. Your hand is very good. And if it limps around, you're fine. Like, that hand plays well multi-way.
That's what I figured.
And yeah, I mean, so we were joking with Tommy Angelo about, you know, folding early position blind in PLO, and I would have a tight range here for calling, and I probably wouldn't raise anything. And ace, king, queen, 10 double suited is a hand that's worth calling, but like, it's not that good a spot. I mean, you're out of position. It's just not fun. So I would call, and if a good limp re-raising spot comes up, great. If a good limp calling spot comes up, great. If a good limp fold to a 3-bet spot comes up, that's also great.
So here's how it goes. I complete for $5 more, and then the under the gun player, who I mentioned is this person I thought was probably on the overly splashy side, he raises to $30. I also think there's a chance that, I mean, he had been changing up his preflop raise sizing a little bit. It wasn't obvious to me that it was based on something other than, you know, whether or not he had really premium hands. So I think there's at least a chance that he would have made a larger raise than this, like that this is a pot sweetener and he would have made a larger raise if he had a different kind of hand. Could be wrong about that, but I think there's at least a chance that's true. A player who is probably the reason that the game is going calls in middle position. Another one of the better players in the game calls in the cutoff. I guess it's probably the button straddle who called there. The small blind put in another 20, and this struck me as a pretty good spot to pot it, given that I think I have a hand that can flop a lot of equity, and I think that the under the gun raiser is not particularly nutted. So I potted it, made it 180. Is this the sort of good limp re-raising spot you were thinking of?
Yeah, I think so. If you suspected the player of being a bit tighter, I wouldn't fault you for not having any 3-bet range here, but here I think you should have a 3-bet range. I think it should have some aces in it. I think it should have some other hands. The biggest problem with re-raising ace, king, queen, 10 double suited is that it'll hit some of the boards that they expect you to hit because they'll put you on aces a lot, but you're just going to hit a lot of boards like this. So I don't think calling would be a terrible play. Folding would be a terrible play. The three betting is good. I like having a 3-betting range. I like putting this in it.
Okay. And I guess I should mention as well, I have about $3,000 at this point as a result of winning some pots when I only had $2,000. So I did not buy up, but I did run it up a little bit. So I'm now playing a $3,000 stack. I'm pretty sure everyone in this hand covers me.
Mm-hmm.
So I make it 180, and everybody except the small blind calls, meaning under the gun, middle position, and button, all call me.
Mm-hmm.
We go to the flop with $750 in the pot. It is Ace of Diamonds, Nine of Clubs, Seven of Clubs. I have Spades and Hearts, so no flushes or backdoor flushes for me. I'm again holding Ace, King, Queen, Ten, and the board is Ace, Nine, Seven with two clubs. I started with a check. It didn't seem like I had a hand good enough to bet, but this was already a spot where I was like, I don't know, maybe I'm supposed to bet here, but I think probably not.
Yeah, I would check here. You have a hand that's probably no good, and it's going to be very hard to improve. And even if people put you on three aces, a lot of them can probably draw to beat that hand.
That's the thing. I was like, there's so many hands I'm not going to bet people off of anyway.
Yeah, and you don't have the ace of clubs because you're double suited in hands that are not clubs. There was a time I've played in PLO games where most of the table would fold by the river. Like, if you bet here, they would put you on three aces and act accordingly. So there are games where you can play the house and just pretend you have three aces, and if the draw's brick, you win. I'm not sure this is one of those games. I would just not overthink this, or I mean, maybe I'm underthinking it, but I would say my hand is probably no good. There are a whole boatload of people in this pot. Mine is not the best hand. Am I going to throw money in this pot out of position? Is this one of the best hands I have for bluffing? No. I check.
Great. Everybody else checks, and the turn is the Jack of Spades. So now Ace of Diamonds, Nine of Clubs, Seven of Clubs, Jack of Spades, and I am holding Ace, King, Queen, 10 with no flush draw. So I've now turned a wrap, but I still have... I have top pair, top kicker, and a wrap, essentially. I went for a check again. I guess I really don't want to get raised if I bet. I don't think my hand is really strong enough to get in. And I guess it seems like a reasonable check calling hand and not really a hand that benefits that much from betting.
Well, if you bet, you can fold out two pair. And yeah, this is a tricky spot, I think. So you do block a little bit of 10-8. Did you think that anybody was debating betting on the flop?
Didn't really seem like it.
Yeah, although that's consistent with 10-8 also. I do think you get some better hands to fold here in a bunch of games if you bet. That said, and also, you're blocking a lot of your own outs. So, like, you know, it's one thing to say, oh, I have a wrap, but then it's another thing to realize you have 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, minus 4, 9 outs. 9 outs? They're all to the nuts. So, I mean, you don't want to fold a 9-out draw to the nuts, but it's not like you've got the main to spain here.
Well,
so,
I mean, it could be a club that would put a... I mean, I don't think it's impossible that someone's holding clubs that they checked.
Oh, that's what I'm saying. Is that, like, you're saying that your hand is so good you don't want to fold it, and I'm saying, like, whoa there, cowboy.
I got you.
Your hand isn't that good. I mean, it's good. You don't really want to fold it, but, like, you know, all wraps are not created equal, and you have one of the crappier ones. How many people are playing here? Four-handed pot? Is that Jimmy, middle position, cutoff? So you're one out of four? I think betting here as a semi-bluff is defensible. I think if there are people who are trying to play well, they're going to fold a lot of two-pair here, and they'll play pretty honest. That said, I think a good standard play here is to check because somebody's got something, and it's hard to fold, you know, to fold them out, and do you really want to be double-barreling? I do think you can, like, it'd be weird to play three aces like this. I think they might not put you on aces, like, not betting the flop when you have the best hand, and then betting the turn and draw gets there. I don't know. I think it's a tricky spot, but I don't fault a check. But I also don't think that your reasons for checking are maybe as airtight as you said. I don't know. It's just a tricky spot.
I did not mean to assert they were airtight.
Yeah.
So everybody checks around again, and the river is the three of hearts. The final board, Ace of Diamonds, Nine of Clubs, Seven of Clubs, Jack of Spades, Three of Hearts. I still have Ace, King, Queen, 10 for top pair, top kicker. Decided not to bluff the river, not to bet. I mean, I don't know if I guess I just never win here. I don't know if Ace, King has, like, any showdown value.
It has showdown value. Yeah
that, I mean, I for whatever, I mean, for right or wrong, I felt like there was a chance I could win without betting. So I checked and checked around one more time, and I lost to somebody holding A7. So I don't know if there was anything I could or should have done differently there, but that was the only remotely interesting pot that I played, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think a7 could easily fold the turn, that's for sure. Right. Would you want to call the turn with a7? but you had a lot of outs against that hand, although probably a lot of them improved other people, too. It's tricky. And John the Lawyer, you should write us and tell us what
I knew
you
that
did.
I was trying to think of, like, who do I know who I could email about a PLO hand? I can't believe John didn't occur to me, but yeah, I'm going to send this to him.
Oh my! Wait! You emailed me and you didn't email John.
Yeah, I'm fishing it up in many ways here. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a huge mistake. So I should apologize to the listeners. I think I've presented some of the right considerations to think about in a PLO hand, but I also think I did not give any particularly good answers. So, if you know PLO, please write in. Let's be interactive about this. podcast@thinkingpoker.net. Tell us what you should have done with this hand.
All right, thanks for your help, Nate, and let's go talk to Clarence.
Let's do it. Thanks very much.
Brokos.
Hey, Daniel, how's it going?
Oh, I was expecting like to actually see you or something. This is my first ever Skype call. I wasn't sure how this worked.
Well, yeah, you can do a video call, but this is just audio. And well, you know what I look like. You're not missing out on anything.
True.
the ladies will be disappointed not to have your face on here, but
I'll make it up to you.
So I'm realizing in thinking about this how little I actually know about you. I mean, I know we've played together in Maryland and in Pittsburgh, although actually the first time we played together in Maryland, I didn't realize immediately who you were.
I saw you were tweeting about me.
Well, yeah, that's what I mean. I didn't realize. And then you were like, oh, cite your sources. And I was like, oh, it's that guy.
Yeah, I thought that was kind of funny, but that's why with these recent Poker Night episodes that have aired, where I look nearly 100% different, I honestly wouldn't expect anybody, if that's like the only place they saw me, to recognize me or know who I was or anything. And so I kind of assumed it could have been something like that. And because, yeah, we only play together maybe once or twice or so, and that was about it.
Yeah, and I'm like, I mean, there's so many people in the poker world where you like kind of vaguely, I mean, you get this especially, I think, walking around like the Rio during WSOP, but there's so many people that you're like, that guy looks familiar, and it's just like you've played at the table with them before, or they were at the next table over. You just like seen them around, but you don't necessarily like know them.
Yeah, no, for sure. And you kind of, you pass them, and then you end up kind of asking somebody, like, I saw this person, they had this, for them to verify who they were. Yeah, I know exactly what you mean.
Well, the other thing that I get, because we've interviewed people on the show who I think, like, you know who I am as an internet presence and like enjoyed talking to us on the show and stuff, but I feel like I'm just going to come across as some random fanboy when I try to like, I have to like get across to them quickly, like, I'm that guy, you were on my podcast, I'm not a crazy person, we can talk, like.
That's funny. Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know, like, is it Daniel, Danny, Dan, what do you go by?
So technically, my birth name is Daniel Richard Wolf, but so people think I'm joking when I say this, but like people in Pittsburgh know me as a different name than people in Maryland. Like dating back to high school, that's how it's always been. Like my high school would call me a different name than a different high school to where I had other friends at. So I've kind of just always had a lot of nicknames, and I kind of tell people maybe three or four of them. And then I'm like, listen, you can just call me whichever you want to, and I'll snap answer to any of them. As soon as I hear any of them, I'm always turning my head thinking somebody's talking to me. But the Daniel, hardly anybody calls me Dan or Daniel. It's mainly Clarence or Cletus, or in Pittsburgh is Baby Dick is what it came to.
Sure, and naturally.
That's why you probably think I'm joking, but I'm being serious. You're like, if I would have been at Rivers the other day when you were there, you might have heard some Baby Dick shouts across the room. And then people who play there often are just, you know, they're immune to it, they're used to it or whatever. But so it honestly depends.
They're used to Baby Dick in Pittsburgh.
What's that?
They're used to Baby Dick in Pittsburgh.
They seriously are. I'm being serious with you. And people always think I'm joking when I tell them that. And then it was funny because there was a Pittsburgh player who was out in Maryland, just a couple days ago, and I walked past his table. I'm like, Brian, he's like, Baby D. He called me. I think he just doesn't feel comfortable adding a dick to it. So he's like, Baby D. I was like, see, this is what, and then he's out there with somebody else, Frank. He's super loud. Like, he's one of the funny ones to shout my name across the room. I was like, see, this is what I mean. Like, as soon as I hear Frank shout my name across the room, then, you know, they'll finally know that I wasn't joking with them. But it was a nickname that somebody made for me, and I mean, it doesn't bother me or anything. You can't argue with people to tell them what to call you. So you just kind of take the nicknames and go with them.
Well, and that's one of the nicer things I've heard Frank call somebody.
Oh, so you know Frank then.
I certainly know Frank, yeah. I used to play that big game in Pittsburgh every week.
Okay, yeah. So if you can imagine Frank, you know, shouting Baby Dick across the room.
That's easy to imagine.
And it's funny, and he's one of the ones I was getting a crack out of it. So yeah, he was the Frank I was talking about, who was out in Maryland recently.
Yeah.
Yeah, they all that's what they all call me. So I think in Maryland it's more Cletus or Clarence or Fetus. They call me, like, those are the main three.
Now, where does Clarence come from? You said Daniel Richard Wolf was your name.
Yeah, so that's actually my self-proclaimed name. Yeah, and I always feel stupid. Especially when I was out at Bellagio a couple months ago, and they always ask you for your card. You know, they're like, well, what's your name? And I tell them Clarence, and I give them my ID, and there's Clarence nowhere on my license. And they kind of stare at it, and they ask you where Clarence comes from. And then when I'm like, well, that's my self-proclaimed name, they kind of just look at you, and then they're like, all right, I'm just going to give this ID back and go with Clarence. But that's a lot of people call me Clarence, like a lot of people.
Okay, so you're saying self-proclaimed name as though that's like a thing that I would know what you mean by that. What is you just like decided you liked Clarence better than Daniel?
It's a name. If you want to know the origin of it, I can tell you it, but it's literally a name that I came up with for myself that I wanted to be called.
Just because you didn't like Daniel or Richard or Wolf or Baby Dick?
Well, so at the time I was actually out at visiting Penn State. You know, this was years ago. My buddy went out. He attended Penn State, and we were going to a frat party out there. And these two people came walking up to us, these two girls, and they were asking us where we're going, da-da-da-da-da. They're like, oh, so what are your names? By that point, they were going to go to this party with us. And he said his name, and I just, off the top of the head, I said Clarence. And I'm not sure exactly why, but I didn't want to tell him my real name just because – if you're kind of a frat party, you never know. Like, if someone dating a guy who lives in the frat, this or that, they know your real name. Now you kind of have like a trail from them to follow. So I just said Clarence because I didn't really want these people knowing my real name. And then ever since that night, I actually feel like a Clarence. And so, and years now, I've gone by Clarence. And it's what I would say the majority of people, I think, call me Clarence.
So what's your backstory? How'd you get started in poker?
Growing up, my family was always kind of polar opposites. My mom's side was the very kind of like, you know, like no alcohol, no gambling, nothing like that. You know, the very religious side. And then on my dad's side, it was my aunts are amongst the loudest and most perverted people you could ever meet in the world. And so my dad's side, like family reunions and everything, everybody's drunk. And my dad's side of the family always played poker. And so I always, I don't know, probably like when I was around 5 or so, when my dad first taught me how to play poker, like 3-card draw. And then maybe when I was 10 or so, I would always meet. And my older brothers, we'd play at family reunions and such. And then for my 21st, I kind of didn't want to go to a bar or anything. I wanted to go to the casino. So my two older brothers took me to the casino for my 21st. And I really didn't hang out with them at all. I just sat at it was probably a 1-2 or 1-3. And then I just really liked it. And then long story short, after playing part-time for maybe like 2 or 3 years, probably like losing for the first year or two, I decided it was finally time to give it the full time go ahead, give it the shot.
And that was how long ago? I don't even really have a sense of how old you are.
I'll be 26 in 7 days. It's going on. It's actually going on the 2 year mark since I decided to quit my job to play poker full time. So going on 2 years, which I don't think is very long for.
It's longer than many people make it.
I never thought of it that way. I guess that's the way to look at it.
I think you've probably passed the mean amount of time for someone who quits a job and declares he's going to be a professional poker player.
My goal from when I quit my job was to just never go broke once. Because I always hear everybody goes broke at least one time.
No, that's very false.
I always thought everybody went broke at least one time. Like, everybody.
Maybe, like, pre-2000 that was true. But, no, I think there's plenty of successful professionals these days who are not going broke. I mean, there's just way more small-stakes games available now than there used to be. Like, it used to be if you wanted to make a living at poker, you had to be playing big games, and it was hard to get bankrolled for them, but... I mean, if you're playing, like, 2-5 and going broke, I think you're doing something wrong.
Well, I'm still going to say I'm not doing something wrong. So I'll still keep that as my, hey, if we never go broke, then maybe we made it.
What was the job that you quit?
So I was my job title was a calibration technician. And I had went to college. Usually nobody's ever heard of this. I'll ask you. Like, you seem pretty intelligent. Maybe you've heard of this, but...
My smarts are all book smarts. Anything technician, I don't know what it is.
Okay, so the field that I had graduated college in was in the field of metrology, which is not meteorology, as most people always like to think that I was going to be a weatherman. But basically, metrology is precision measurement technology. It's along the field. It was a degree in sciences, and so I graduated with that degree, and I had worked an internship, and then I was at my job. That internship turned into a full-time job offer, which I accepted, and I was at that job. I left just after my three-year mark. I actually think I had to stay there for 3 years to get my 401k and everything invested. And then it was like the very next day after all of my 401k and everything else that becomes vested after 2 years, because I had a 1 year internship. Mm-hmm. So I waited 2 years for everything to become vested. And then I put in my 2 weeks the next day to tell them that I was leaving to play poker. And most people kind of just didn't believe me. As the case today, after no matter what I say to anybody, most people don't believe me, no matter what it is. But, so that's what I did. I worked as a calibration technician.
How'd your mom's family react to the professional poker idea?
So my mom is a great parent and a great mother in the sense that she's always giving me that unconditionally love, you know, like you just know no matter what, like your mom loves you, which is a great feeling. But basically all she told me was I'm just happy that you're able to do something that you enjoy. So she didn't really have an opinion on it, whether it was a good idea or a bad idea. She was just happy that I came to a conclusion by myself to pursue something that I had a passion for. And then, I don't know. I think the rest of her family is happy for me also, obviously, but maybe they have some opinions they're kind of biting their tongue about, but it's been a couple years now and I still haven't been, you know, shot or killed by the mafia. Like a lot of, I think, kind of get the idea about poker and everything. So overall, I think they're just happy to see me doing well and to just be able to do something that I enjoy for a living. So yeah, it's a very supportive family for sure.
What was your setup when you quit the job? I mean, were you already winning at 2-5? Did you have a bankroll for 2-5? Did you get staked?
So let me start off by saying I am the absolute worst person in the universe to get bankroll advice from. I've always just been ride or die. Like it's not good. But I think because when I started playing, since I was still working full time, I kind of was just in the habit of, well, I'll just like shot take this game. And since I'm working full time, I can just replenish my role if I need to. I would say when I quit my job, I had basically at Rivers, which is where I would play at, it was basically all 1-3 that I was playing, and it would be the occasional 2-5 or 5-5 maybe on the weekends. And so I would say I was a 1-3 crusher, I guess, by my hourly, as you could say. And then I was showing like improvement in 2-5 and 5-5. And so that's probably where my skill level was at when I decided to leave my job, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Was there a plan? Were you just sort of like, well, I'll just play 1-3? I mean, knowing that you didn't really have access to bigger games consistently in Pittsburgh, were you just planning on playing 1-3 indefinitely, or was there an idea of like, I'm going to run it up and then try to move somewhere where I can play a bigger game more consistently?
So I actually had a master, as I always do. I spent a lot of time thinking, and I had a master plan. So like everybody always wants to ask about like your benefits and like retirement and all that, like when you're quitting a job, and like I had all this stuff thought out. And then when it comes to poker, as you know, Chad Power and his staking stable. So basically, I told my buddy, I was like, he was like my best poker buddy, and I told him, I was like, listen, if you want to take poker seriously, you have to move to where it can be taken seriously. And so basically, we had the idea in place that we were moving from Pittsburgh, and we were either going to move to Maryland, Florida, or LA or Vegas. For lots of reasons, Maryland was the best fit, and we had already basically had our quote-unquote interview with Chad, and he was accepting to stake us. So before I quit my job, I knew that we had a place already set up in Maryland that we had visited, and so we had a place locked up. We had the stake in the coaching by Chad locked up, and so that gave me a lot of confidence to make this move. And obviously getting coached by Chad, it's you're like almost guaranteed to be a 2-5, at least decent winner, I would think. And so that kind of, I didn't have as much pressure to where I'm sure most would feel when, you know, they're just on their own dime and they're new to this and they're trying to move up in stakes. And so I had all that sorted out, which greatly aided into my confidence to leave my job.
So you're headed off to the great state of Maryland. Then what happens?
So yeah, essentially, I remember after I quit my job, and then I remember that summer I was out in Vegas for the first time with three other friends who were also out in Vegas for the first time, and I also decided to buy a newer car. And then after the Vegas trip and the car purchase, I was like, wow. It is very good that I have this stake right now, because my role was not what it was when I quit my job, and I felt very comfortable about grinding. And so essentially we just moved out, me and a good buddy from here in Pittsburgh, we moved out to Maryland. And then when I first got on stake, it was way better than what I could imagine. I just, I think I picked up on Chad's coaching pretty quickly, and I also kind of just like, I just played with a lot of confidence, and I also ran very, very well. And it was just like the best, like 3 or 4 months ever, like right off the bat. And it was just, it was all going super smoothly for sure. Yeah.
What did you get from the coaching? Anything you can talk about specifically?
See, the one day Chad asked me, he's like, And I'll go back. I have a few conversations or so from like way back when of like hands that I would play. And Chad asked me like, you know, if I had like a pre-flop raising size or this or that, and or, you know, just like a strategy that I would play with and all that stuff. I was like, you know what? I don't really think I did, but Chad, I think he's very good at coaching exploitative plays, which is, I think, at the lower stakes is the most important. And so, like, overall, the lower stakes, I kind of just have a exploitative mind, unless if I'm in a hand, which I think is, like, a good reg that I have a lot of respect for, then, like, balance will actually be on my mind. I may play a little differently. But the main thing that Chad gets you to realize is just – it's just the range that you should be targeting, which with each of your bats, and just people's tendencies that you should look out for in ways to exploit those tendencies. So he just kind of overall helped my game a tremendous amount.
So you mentioned a good 3 to 4 months. Was that all the time that you were with him, or did things just you started running less well?
I'm trying to think how much I can say on here. Essentially, what happened was, I guess my poker story to date was, so we move out, get on stake with Chad. I remember, I think my first 12 or 13 sessions under him were all winning sessions. And then I remember I reported a $13 loss, and I texted him and was like, hey, look, I'm sorry for the downswing. Like, I'll be sure to make it up. Like, I was just on this like insane heater. He moved me up to like 5'10 pretty quickly, probably like quicker than he moved anybody else up. And then he gave me a shot in a good 25-50 game. And in that 25-50 game, I turned 5,000 into almost 45,000. Just like kind of, like, I was playing well, but I was also coolering people to be, you know, you had to play well to be able to cooler people, I believe, if that makes any sense. Like, if everybody just knows you're kind of just sitting in the rain for the nights, people can still fool you. But I was just playing really well, and it set up a lot of situations for me to win massive pots. And then after that, probably like 3 or 4 month mark, it kind of started to go downhill a little bit. But those first 3 months were just far more than what I expected. And I probably had a pretty, like, my mind was, oh, this is how poker always is. Like, you want to play full time? Like, this is, oh, like, these 3 months, I'll make this month, like, this much. It's never going to change. And then you kind of hit some, like, run bad. And on the bad side of variance, and then you're like, oh, so this is what it takes to be a full-time pro, to where you got to be able to be able to handle all this mentally and every other way, and just keep playing your best.
Can you take us through a little bit the night when you turned the 5K into the 45K? I would imagine that you had never had a stack, you know, anywhere near that before. So what was
Andrew had asked me. Kind of like what I was playing when I quit my job. And I told him I was playing basically 1-3 full time, and then like occasional 2-5 or 5-5. And at one point I was like still short buying 5-5 when it would run. And a good 10.25 was running. And I was like, I kind of want to play this game. Like, I told Andrew I'm the worst with bankroll management. So my good buddy who I ended up moving out to Maryland with, I was like, yo, like, I need you to loan me like X amount so I can buy into this game. I was like, I promise, I'll give it to you tomorrow. I didn't bring this much with me, you know, I never play this. So anyways, he loans me the money. I go to buy into 10.25. I buy in for $2,500, and I go broke. There was like two good players and like three fish at the table, and I was like, look, I'm just gonna like play hands versus the fish. I played with them before. I'm just gonna like avoid these pros. Anyways, the very first hand I'm dealt in, I lose my buy-in, calling down like one of the pros. The very And so I go back to my buddy. He's like, yo. He's like, yo, you need. He's like, you have a question this or that? I was like, dude, I lost. He's like, what do you mean? I was like, I lost my first hand. Right? It's just the way she goes. And he's like, looking at me like I'm joking. And so like I go from like basically being a 1-3 grinder to like shot taking this 10.25, right? And that was the only time I played anything higher than 5-5. So when I'm in this 25-50 game, I remember at one point I was up to somewhere between like 15 and 20,000. And maybe I go from like 20,000 to 17,000. I'm sitting there counting my chips, like after every hand. Like if I lose $100 or like $200, I'm counting my chips. And I'm like, geez, I just want a 3K downswing. And that's humongous for 1-3 or whatever I'm used to playing. And then I kind of just told myself, I was like, listen, this is what you – like. One of the main reasons I wanted to get staked by Chad is because I wanted to play the highest stakes possible. Like, I wanted to become a high stakes crusher. I was like, listen, just get the money out of your mind and just play poker and just make the correct decision and don't worry about winning or losing, but just play well. And then I remember the one hand, it was actually against Chad. We got in, it was around 15,000 pre-flop. I had aces and he had kings. I cooler him. Another hand, I flop pops out of aces, and I have this dude trying to bluff me. and then just like all these hands. And like, once I kind of, it was after like, listen, like, don't worry about how much money this is, just play good poker. It was like, by the end of the night, I was up to like 45,000 after a couple coolers and, you know, making some good folds or whatever the hell I was doing. But I remember I had to like tell myself, don't let this money dictate how you play, because that's just not, it's not good. Just do what you were taught, do what Chad told you to do. And then at the end of the day, if you can explain your play, whether you won or lost a hand, just have explanation for what you did. So when I first got up to, when I first ran the 5 into 15 or so, I was just on lockdown. And then I just had to tell myself to get that out of your mind and just try and play the best you can. And it ended up being just a crazy night that I would have never expected, like, ever, especially 3 months into after quitting my job.
And now, were you able to do that in the opposite direction when you went back to play in 2-5 or whatever the next day after winning 40,000 the previous night? Were you able to say, oh, they're just chips, like, I'm going to, you know, play well with decisions I can justify?
And a lot of people say that, but I've left 10 and a quarter games before to go play in a 2-5. I think it takes some time. I'm not going to sit here and say, like, oh, I've always been able to, like, jump from stake to stake or whatever. Because, yeah, there's for sure times I would just punt. But I think where I'm at now is you just have to realize what you're playing and just play accordingly. Like I said, like, 1-3 and 2-5, I'm just basically, I'm just thinking, like, okay, I'm probably better than this person, you know, like a lot of like 2-5 rec players. And so I'm going to play differently. But at a 5-10 table or higher, you kind of have to have at least a little bit more respect for people for sure and play differently. And so at the beginning, no, I wasn't able to just go back to 2-5 and play normal. But over time, I feel as though I'm able to realize what I'm playing and play accordingly.
Are you still with Chad, or did you go off on your own?
So I'm still with Chad. It's not, I'm 100% with him. But certain games, certain times, he does have my action. Other times he does not. So it's not a complete 100%, but it's also like we just parted ways.
Do you live in the house that those guys have?
No, I've never lived in the poker house. Since I moved out to Maryland with my buddy from Pittsburgh, him and I have always lived together and we've had our own place together. And so I've never actually lived with Chad or the other people.
Would we be skipping a lot if I asked you about Poker Night in America now? Is there other stuff on the timeline we should be hitting?
So I guess if you want to ask me about Poker Night in America and so you've seen me recently, Andrew. If you just saw me on Poker Night, would you ever recognize me from what you saw on TV, like with my hair and like just how everything else? Would you think that was me?
Well, I was hoping to sort of sidestep this, but I haven't actually seen the Poker Night in America that that you were on. So okay. I don't really know what you looked like on the. I just know that you were on it.
Nah, I kind of just went off the deep end. No, I'm being 100% serious. Like, when I say like the first like X amount of months on stake with Chad was great, and then I kind of just had like personal issues that I was dealing with. And for anybody, I guess, who's been playing poker a while, I guess you learn how to separate personal issues from playing poker. But probably the first time that personal issues are really bothering you, you're just sitting at the poker table being miserable, like not caring about money, not caring about that. And so you just kind of like, I just kind of went off the deep end, like didn't care about much. And then like, I looked like, I really looked idiotic on that show, to be honest. And so like, there's like some things that led up to Poker Night in America, but if you have like specific questions or whatever, you ask away, I'll answer them.
Well, what led up? Oh, sorry, Nick, go ahead.
How'd you get on the show? I hear it's hard to get on, and it's
this is my claim. I think so far it's my only claim to fame. But so what Poker Night in America started to do was they started running a sit and go. It was an $1,100 sit and go, and if you win that sit and go, you win a seat onto the game from like, you know, like a 4-hour time frame or whatever. And since it's $1,100 sit and go, you win $10,000 to play with. And the very first sit and go that they ever had was held at Rivers in Pittsburgh. And so I was the winner of the first ever Poker Night in America sit and go. And that's how I got on the show. And then when I first got on the show, I kind of came in since like I was kind of free rolling 10K, I guess essentially like 9K. I was like, look, I'm just going to like come in guns blazing. You know, I'm just going to, and I part of the, to this point, I played like 10 and a quarter plus maybe twice in my life. And so I just came in. I never once like let the fact that I was playing on camera or anything make me play differently or anything like that. But I lost a lot the very first day I was on it. And then I think Glance, I still talk to Matt Glance, and like I think he's a super cool dude. And so like him and I keep in touch every now and again. But I kind of became friends with him. And so the next day, which was Saturday, there was a seat open. He's like, hey, do you want to play? I was like, yeah, sure. And then Sunday again, there was a seat and they let me play. So I got on the first time by winning the sit and go. And then I kind of became friends with them and I didn't just sit there and knit it up. And so I guess they wanted me on the show again for whatever reason. And then I played on it a few more times. And now Glance kind of just told me, he's like, look, if you want to be on the show, just let me know in advance if you can, and I'll do my best to have a seat open for you.
Wait, so you're the guy who got to play and Berkey didn't get to play. We just had Berkey on the show talking about how he was cranky that he didn't get to play and how like people put their friends on the show. And now we're talking to the friend. So that's cool.
No, I don't think so. Was that – you're not talking down in Florida, are you?
I could be – I know Berkey's from Pittsburgh, so I might be mixing something up. I've heard many complaints from people who just talk about people putting their friends on the show, but I could be totally wrong about that.
I mean, that could be true in a sense, but I haven't played on the show since last April. And I think last time Berkey played on it, I know he was playing in that – whatever the hell it was. It was like a 50, 100, 200, 400, 800 game down in Florida.
But yeah, that was awesome.
It was great. But no, I actually haven't played on it since last April. But I guess just in a general sense, I'm sure people who are friends with people on the show, I guess maybe can have an easier way of getting on it. But I would think Berkey is somebody who, if he like contacted any of them and wanted to be on the show, that they would certainly like to have him. But I would say no, that I was the friend that kept Berkey off.
Unfortunately, there's not time for me to go back and check all my facts before I crack jokes on air, which probably I should just be more restrained about that. But you said it didn't let you affect your play of the camera. I found that it's a lot easier to say that something won't affect your play than to actually not let it affect your play, certainly including TV cameras. It's a heck of a skill. Like what is it about like your approach that lets you shut other things out like that?
I think maybe since the first time I played on the show, and maybe since it was in my home casino and I knew a lot of the people, that maybe I just felt comfortable, like just the environment in general, I felt comfortable. Or maybe I just never really thought, I have no idea how many people watch the show or stream the show. So maybe I just didn't really think it was no big deal at all. But I don't know. I just like never once when I was sitting there thinking of like never once if I'm sitting there thinking of calling, did it cross my mind like, well, if I call and I'm wrong, I look dumb. Or if I fold and I was bluffed, I look dumb. I don't know. I just don't ever. It just never crosses my mind when I'm playing if that other people might see this and might judge me for it. I don't know if there's a specific reason, but I just don't ever think that way when I'm playing.
And probably the lineup was different from what you're used to. Probably well-known players there and not people you would see at a standard 5-10 game, or at least a 5-10 game you would really like to be playing in. How did that sort of adjustment process go?
I told Glances, so it was... I just kind of knew all these people, like David Baker, Mac Lance, and all these other people. Like I kind of just knew their poker name, right? And I told Glance this. Like I said, me and Glance are buddies. And last time we were commentating shortly in Pittsburgh, and I have a hand against Glance. I don't know if it made one of the episodes or not, but I was three betting a lot. Anyways, I finally three bet him with aces, and he calls me with the jacks, and it comes queen jack, whatever, and he checks. I check back my aces. Anyways, the rest of the hand goes, he bets turn, and then he bets like decently large on the river. And on the river, I'm just like, he's never like value betting like ace queen for this size, probably not even kings for this size. So I don't think he's value betting worse for this size. So he has to have some bluffs here. And I'm like, whoa, it's Matt Glantz. Like, he's like, and I told him this, I'm like, Matt, I gave you credit for being good and for having bluffs in your range here. And so I called you with aces. And then he just flips over jacks, you know, for it was a queen jack, whatever flop. So he flopped the set. And then after it goes check, check, he leads. And I was like, and I told him, I was like, and it still makes me mad to this day that I called him, because I just like, I really didn't think he had any bluffs, because it was like queen jack three rainbow and then turns whatever. Maybe there was a backdoor flush that hit the turn. But I'm like king tens is, or nine, ten suited, it's like his only bluffs or whatever. But I was like, but it's Matt Glantz. It's like, he could be bluffing. Like, he's really good. And so I remember in that specific hand, I called only because I thought he could have bluffs in his range. And then I just told him, I was like, Matt, now I realize that, like, you're a dog, bro. Like, you're never, like, you never have bluffs here. I can just easily fold. And he kind of just laughed when I told him that, or told him that. But that's the only, I think that might be one of the only hands where I really, like, took who, like, their name and their reputation and everything and made a different play because of that. But I never try and play like being intimidated.
It's interesting, because one thing that you do get either in big tournaments or in TV games is sometimes people who are not no limit players playing no limit because the spot is good. And I think Matt falls into that category. I mean, I can't imagine Matt Glantz listens to the show, but
I told Andrew and, you know, everybody else, Nate, and everybody else who listens to the show, like, I don't think you're that good now. So maybe we'll then.
Well, I mean, the point is, like, he's a limit player. I think he makes his living in like 200, 400 games. So, I mean, I do think that's an actual skill in tournaments, and especially the main event, is that you get people who are either mixed game players or random Vegas pros or whatever, and you have to play no limit against people who are not no limit players. And for whatever it's worth, I think that makes it more, even more of a fold. But
for sure, that's what I realized now. So I'm still mad at myself.
Like, oh man, it's not just that you're crappy, it's that you're a crappy limit player. I totally should have folded my aces.
Yeah, no, I was just like, I really didn't know what Matt Glantz was at the time. Like, there's still a lot of like awesome tournament pros and people that I'm not too familiar with, and I just knew Matt was just some super popular poker player. So I just thought he was a super crusher even at no limit, and I was like, every like crusher has bluffs in every spot, I would think. Like, there would be some imbalance. And so I called him, and then he flipped it over, and I was like, I was really mad at myself. Like, I was just mad at myself. But yeah, I thought he could have some bluffs. And then
trust the gray hair. Always trust the gray hair, man.
This old dude's not bluffing me right now for or whatever you bet. He's not bluffing me. I should have realized that. And that's one of the hands that really make me, like, it still makes me mad, because it's just a fool that I know I'm capable of, but in the moment I wasn't able to make it, and I made the wrong assumption. And so yeah, that one still it makes me mad. I still get mad about hands from a few years ago.
Did you have a sense going on the show of like wanting to, you know, make a name for yourself, or sort of seeing this as like your chance to become a more prominent poker player?
So here's what I want to say about that. I remember I got to play with Phil Locke when I was on the show, and like, me and Phil kind of became buddies. I remember before he left Pittsburgh that week, and he's like, he calls me Cletus. He's like, Cletus, take my number, like, da 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 da. And like, Phil, like, if I ever text him, like, hey Phil, like, I remember one time I was like down in the dumps, and I was like, I sent him this text message, and I was like, and then he like calls me, he sends me this really long text message back, and then he calls me, he's like Cletus, I just needed to call you after that. And I've hung out with Phil a couple times, you know, like 2-3 times or whatever. And I think when people first see Phil, or maybe years ago, they're like, oh, he's putting on this act, like, you know, for poker and for TV. But it's like, Phil is the same person on the poker table that he is off the table. And So anybody who plays with me and has played with me a lot, like Andrew, you play with me quite a bit. Like you were quoting stuff that I was saying and you didn't even know who I was. I know, and I don't know if this is a good thing or a bad thing. It might be a bad thing, but I'm the same person on the poker night show that I am at a 1-3 table. You know, we're all spending, anybody who plays poker for a living, we're all spending, I don't know, 20, 30, 40, 50 more hours a week sitting at this poker table. You can either be buried in your Netflix or whatever the hell you're watching, or you can just try and make friends and just make the environment, the casino, more fun and just have more fun when you're playing live poker. And so nothing I did or said or anything on that show was to try and make a name for myself. And I would say that anybody who has played with me, like before the show, after the show, or whatever, like they know that this is just who I am and it's just my personality, and I'm not changing that at all to try and be better for TV. It's just, I'm just going to be myself, and that's the way it's always been.
Yeah, I was actually kind of surprised when you said that you want a satellite to go on Poker Night in America, because I can imagine if, you know, Matt just sort of sat down with the powers that be at Rivers or whatever and said, you know, who are some people who would be good candidates for the show? Just kind of people who are capable of playing higher stakes and also have, entertaining personalities. I would expect that your name would come up on that list anyway. So it didn't seem like there needed to be like a separate explanation for why you would be invited on the show.
The one guy who plays in at Rivers a lot, I actually tagged him I posted a picture today on Twitter, and I said, this is my dad to my left, and his name's Art, but he always tells me that if I'm not the absolute weirdest person that he's ever played poker with in Pittsburgh, that I'm top three for sure. Like, he always tells me that. But that's why, you know, when I say I'm no different on the show than people who have known me for years, anybody would attest to that anything I say or do is no different than people who play with me on a daily basis. And that's why I wanted to make sure. That's why, like, when they, I don't think you've seen it yet, but when they wanted to wheel me out in the wizard outfit, like, I just thought it was too far of a disconnect from poker to want to do that. But like everybody who was back there, like, no, like, this would be the greatest thing ever. You got to do it. Like, everybody was telling me that. I was like, all right, whatever. But I just felt like it was too much of a disconnect from poker for, like, the wizard outfit or whatever. Like, I'll never do that again in a poker setting unless it was Halloween or something. Then, yeah, I'll wear my necromancer outfit. But it was like the one thing where I felt like I'm not trying to create a character for the show. Like, you know, they were like, what were they calling me? Soggy Wizard or the Wizard of Cletus. I don't know what the hell they were calling me. But
wait, so did they give you a wizard outfit to wear? Or you... You had a wizard outfit with you?
Super geek. A lot of sense to me. Like, I bought a necromancer outfit from the Renaissance Fair that I went to.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know how the hell they... I don't know. I wore it for Halloween that year, but, like, they all wanted me to wear it onto the show. And, I was just like, but this doesn't have anything to do with poker. You know what I mean? It's not... It just... But everybody's like, no, it'd be the greatest thing.
Wait, so how do they know that a necromancer, that you own a necromancer costume?
I don't know. I might have, was there a picture on Twitter or, I don't know. Like, cause there was, I think Glance knew, like, of a picture, like, I mean, the necromancer outfit. And then, like, I went to the Texas Rodeo and I was in, like, dressed up all for this Texas Rodeo and other things. And I don't know. I don't know how the hell it came up. But they wanted me to wear it, and then I was just, all right, whatever. But I actually kind of regret doing it, because I feel like it was, like, trying to be flashy or something, and, like, trying to create this character. But I don't know. They don't want me to do it, so, like, whatever. But that was mainly, like, the only time where I was, like, kind of out of my comfort zone, I guess, so to say. But other than that, everything I do and say on the show is just... I'm
kind of
just not normal.
I'm gonna let you drop this line of conversation in just a second here, but I want to pick up the bit about the rodeo, because I listen to a lot of country music, And there's a lot there about Texas rodeos, and I haven't heard anything about wizard costumes and like that. Like, that's just not the attire I had in mind. Like, is it true that you go to the rodeo in a wizard costume?
No. I'm sorry. Maybe I misspoke. The wizard costume I'd wore for Halloween, okay?
Okay.
But at a different time, I had went to the Texas rodeo, and I had this, like, whole, like, cowboy outfit on. A different time, I went to Good Morning America out in L.A., and I had this, like, whole different attire on. You know, like, I guess maybe I kind of take different forms, but they had saw the wizard costume, and they liked it, and they thought it would be good for me to wear that to the show.
Okay. Okay. Okay, so the rodeo was just like a different case of you dressing up.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that was a totally different time and case. Yeah.
All right, I understand. Okay, I'll drop this now. But thanks for clearing that up.
Yeah, I'm not doing that. I'm not wearing a wizard costume to a rodeo.
Well, the question I was going to ask you is only slightly tangential, which is to explain about the baby that you carry with you.
So here's what I gotta say about the baby. As far as my knowledge, there's only one person who knows fully what the story of the baby is. It's the only person I've ever like truly like told like in full about the baby, because I used to kind of tell people like kind of like here or there, and like when I very first started using it, and nobody would believe me. And like, it just, that's one of my, like, I hate, that's one of my pet peeves. Like, I'm not going to lie to you. Like, if you ask me what I have in a hand and I fold and I tell you, I'm like, I'm actually going to tell you the truth. I know nobody does that, but like, I'm not going to lie to you. Like, I just hate when I'm telling somebody the truth and they don't believe me. So when I was telling people like why I use this baby and nobody would believe me, I'm just like, all right, I'm done telling people. But there's like one person who I ever told that knows the full and absolute story of the baby. And she's actually the person, I don't know when I was playing with you, Andrew, if I had clothes on the baby, but she actually made me clothes for my baby and like a carrying case for it. And there's like a couple stories I make up about it and maybe thrown in there, maybe every now and again, maybe it's a little bit of the truth. But for the most part, I just tell people, listen, nobody ever believes me. So just look at me as like the creepy dude who carries around a mutilated plastic fetus. Just
like, and this is like, I mean, it's not even really a card capper, it's just like a thing that you keep by your chips while you're playing.
No, it caps my cards.
You,
for sure.
You do use it for capping the cards. Okay. People,
like, somebody will like, maybe like every now and again somebody will accidentally muck their cards and like hit somebody else's cards, and I'm like, dude, that's why you need to keep a baby on your cards. And they kind of go, but no, it is, I was at Rivers shortly, like just for a little bit before this, and I had left it in my car, and like it just feels weird for me to put a chip on my cards. You know, I always have something protecting my cards. I feel weird if I don't, but no, it's for sure my card protector. Yeah, it serves a purpose, okay?
It's a baby with a purpose.
Yeah, it's a baby with a purpose, yeah. And it has a bounty on it in lots of different states. That's why whenever I get up from the table, I might leave everything else at the table but my baby, because people always try and steal it from me. And so I'm just in the habit, whenever I get up from the table, I take it with me because people want to take it from me and hold it for ransom.
So what's the future look like for you? Are you in poker for the foreseeable future?
I would hope so. As I said earlier, I don't ever want to go broke. And so, you know, anybody who plays poker knows, the freedom that comes with poker. And I understand everybody kind of gets burnt out on playing, but I'm still not really at that point. I can still grind a lot of hours and enjoy it. And so, as I feel today, I would love to be able to play poker basically for the rest of my life, you know, make a living from it. But I still have a ton of, like, I feel like I haven't accomplished anything in the poker world. So I'm still very determined and motivated to keep getting better and to accomplish a lot. But yeah, I don't, if all goes to plan, I don't want to get a normal job anytime soon.
Is there anything specific you're looking to accomplish?
I just want to become much better at higher stakes. Like, there's absolutely nothing wrong with, like, crushing 2-5 games, you know, or, like, 5-10. Like, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. But I like to set my goals high, and I want to become the best at, you know, 10 a quarter and plus that I can. And, you know, people always say it that, like, cash game players get no love, this and that. Like, you got to, like win some tournaments, you know, to get, like, recognition, this and that. But it's not that, but it would just be the feeling. I don't play many tournaments. I ran maybe, I guess what you would say, like, relatively deep in a couple of tournaments last summer in the World Series. But I would still love to have that, you know, that, like, huge tournament score under my belt also, to where you just have an outrageous score, and it's great for yourself. If people bought pieces of you, like, you know, you're, like, handing, like, best friends, like, good chunks of money, and it just, like, makes a ton of people happy. And so I still feel like I haven't accomplished kind of, like, anything. And so I'm still looking at it from this day forward that I have a lot to do to get better at cash and to get better at tournaments also.
Has it been different from what you envisioned when you quit your job?
I don't know what the hell I envisioned when I quit my job. I really don't. So I remember telling somebody at one point, I was like, I pretty much basically told them, I was like, no matter how much money I make from poker, I would ever quit my job to play full time. Like, I would never want that because of the stress and everything. But I kind of don't know what I was expecting when I quit my job. I really don't know if I thought it would be easy, if I thought there'd be lots of ups and downs. If I don't know. I honestly can't say. I don't know exactly what I thought it would be like when I quit my job. I just knew that this is something I had a passion for. I always had my whole life. And where I'm at now, this is the time while I'm young and single and everything to quit my job and give it that shot. And so I kind of don't know what I expected. I just knew that this is the time to give the shot and then just see how it goes.
But you mentioned stress. Has it been stressful?
For sure. I think the worst thing about me is, like, I get over, like I said, I'm terrible with bankroll management. Like, I'll lose, like, I might, like, shot take and lose way more than I should. And, like, I'm like, like, I hate it for, like, a day or, like, that night. And then the next day I wake up and I'm just like, I just want to go grind. I want to go grind. And then when, like I said, when you're adding, like, personal issues into it that, like, are stressful, and then you're adding the stress of losing, it can definitely be stressful. But I just try and tell myself that, you know what? Like, to this point, I've met a lot of great friends. I've went on a lot of fun trips. And everything I have now is because of poker. So even if I lose everything, the only reason I had that to lose was because of poker. And so be grateful for that you worked hard enough. You know, like, people are always, like, they might be, like, if you tell someone, oh, I lost 2,000 yesterday or 5,000 yesterday or whatever, they might be like, dude, what's your problem? Like, to go and lose that much money. But, like, it's like, the only reason I had that to lose is because I saved that up and I built that up through poker. And so I try and, instead of looking at it as a bad thing that I lost X amount of money, I try and look at it as a good thing that I was even able to lose this much money because I was able to dedicate time and everything else into something I love, to have this money to lose because I did well to this point. And so it can definitely be stressful, but I think at the end, anybody should be able to agree that it's all been worth it and to just be grateful for what you've been able to do up to this point, but also try and build on it to better from here going forward.
Are you having fun on a day-to-day basis? Like, if you're just sitting in a 2-5 game, you know, grinder, like, whatever is the sort of the smallest stakes that you're playing nowadays, I mean, does it feel like a job or fun or both?
No. Overall, I still definitely have fun. You know, you walk into a poker room, if it's one of your, you know, like, familiar poker rooms, you have a lot of friends in there, you're excited to see all of them. And I try to never look at it as a job, even though very occasionally, like, you're sitting there like, I need to just sit here and, like, if you're at the type of table to where like you're just like there's no bluffing, like you're just like I need to just sit here and wait for hands, and it's kind of boring or you're getting frustrated, you know, or whatever, but like you just got to tell yourself like what I was trying to tell myself. Have you ever watched The Godfather? Are you a fan of those movies?
I've not seen three, but I'm certainly well familiar with the first two.
Maybe so. I forget which one it is, but I think it's Hyman Roth. I think it's number two, and he's like, you know, he says, this is the profession we've chosen. You know, he's like, I didn't ask who sent the order because it had nothing to do with business. But like that, this is the profession that we've chosen. That always stuck in my mind that if there's any a day that like if there's ever a day that goes by to where you're hating poker, like tell yourself, well, you know what? This is the profession that you've chosen and you're going to have days like this. So don't complain about it and realize this is just one of maybe the few negatives that come with the job. And so just get through that day and keep going forward. So that's, I don't know if that makes sense to anybody else. Things make sense in my mind, but you know, it just does. But I'm trying to like tell myself, listen, we're going to have these few bad days, but look at the overall picture, but this is the profession you've chosen. And so realize this is one of the few negatives of it.
All right. Anything else you wanted to talk about that we didn't get to?
Andrew, I can talk about anything.
I mean, I don't know you well enough to know if I'm like failing to ask you about something really important.
I mean, it's honestly all up to you. I mean, if there's any more questions you have, or I mean.
All right, well, you're Wolf_Clarence on Twitter. Anywhere else if people are looking to get more baby dick?
Tinder. No. I'm on Twitter, I guess, sometimes. I don't have an Instagram or nothing like that. I'm not like too big into any of that. But yeah, they can find me on Twitter. About it, I guess. I don't know if you two have any questions, whether it's about poker, anything else. I mean, I don't know. It's all up to you.
I don't know, Nate. Anything else you wanna get out of him?
I think that'll do it. Thanks very much for coming on, being a good sport. I hope we play together someday.
Andrew, can I ask you this?
Yeah,
so, this just popped into mind, right? So, like, the recent episodes of Poker Night in America, like, when they aired on YouTube, mm-hmm. like, so I'll go read the comments on YouTube and stuff, and it's like, this, like, Wolf, he needs shot in the head. And, like, people just telling me how, like, I'm, like, the worst player in the world, like, the most annoying person in the world. And this actually came up a few nights ago when I was playing at Rivers, and, like, everybody's like, nah, man, like, I think I do annoy a lot of people at first. Like, a lot of people who are very good friends of mine now, especially through poker, we didn't get along at the beginning. But I guess what I'm asking you is, since, like, you were, like, tweeting some stuff I was saying, and you didn't know it was me, this and that, like, what was your first impression of me at the table?
I didn't find you annoying. And I can imagine how some people would, but I didn't think that you were. And I... it's relatively easy to annoy me. Like,
I was going to say it if you weren't.
I don't think. I mean, I think you contribute to an enjoyable game. I think you're. I mean, there's a reason I was, you know, quote tweeting you, and it wasn't to make fun of you. I mean, I thought the stuff you were saying was legitimately funny, and I've never seen you do anything that I thought was detrimental to the game, you know, other than, I mean, I don't even think you're talking as like, you know, it's not like you won't shut up when people are in a big pot or something. I mean, I think you're talking at appropriate times, and I've never seen you needle somebody in an inappropriate way or like get upset losing up. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that really annoys me, is people who like call themselves professionals and then get upset when they lose like a stack and a half and quit the game or whatever. You know, I've never seen you do that kind of stuff.
I'm glad, because that's why I feel like a lot of outside people, you know, like if their only glance is by Poker Night America, like, yeah, maybe they think that. But that's why, since I knew when I first started playing with you and you didn't know who I am, that you had an unbiased opinion, you know, of what you first thought. And so, because like sometimes I can blurt things out, and it's like, oh, that was offensive, this or that, like whether it's on Facebook or whatever, like people are telling me, like the other day they made me feel like the Antichrist because like a comment I had made and all this stuff. But it seems like over time when people play with me enough or like get to know me that I don't know. I don't ever want to make people not play the game. You know, I want them to have more fun, but then that's why I was wondering what your opinion was. So, you know, I'm glad to hear that. Yeah, I don't like needle people or, you know, complain at the table, this and that, you know, if you take a bad beat or whatever. So, hey, I'm glad I could have your good word on my side.
You're welcome at my table anytime, and it's not because I think you're a fish.
See, that's the best part right there. Thank you.
No, you wouldn't be on the show if I found you. I mean, I guess that's not. We've had one or two people on the show I found annoying, but often that was in retrospect, or I wasn't expecting it to be as bad as it was. But no, I mean, for the most part, it was like if I didn't think I would enjoy talking to you, then you know I wouldn't have invited you on the show. I don't do this for money.
All right, well great, because I appreciate that, and that's why you know, this is like the first time I'd, you know, ever done anything like this.
And look, don't pin your self-esteem to YouTube comments.
I was going to say.
I actually think it's just funny. Like, I can understand why somebody would really take a lot of that stuff to heart, you know, but I've gotten a lot of opinions like that, you know, in person or this and that, you know, but I think it's most important to realize that the people whose opinions you should really value most are the people who know you best, because since they know you best, they have the best opinion, they have the most information about you to form an opinion on. And if they're good friends with you, they're gonna be honest with you. And so all that YouTube stuff, it, you know, I just thought it was funny, but I figured since you didn't know who I was when I first played with you that you would have a good opinion. But that's why I didn't know if people were just bullshitting me or not when they're like, I like playing with you, this or that. So
no, I think there's people who are just kind of like annoyed by silliness in general, especially if they're like stuck in the game or in a grumpy mood or whatever. Like, I can see how some people would just want you to like shut the hell up and sit down or whatever. But no, I like it.
All right, well, thanks. I appreciate that.
Well, pleasure to meet you, and have a good night.
Thank you, Nate. Nice talking to you also.
Thank you.
Devotion of a Carmelite, or the fair passage of a bill, and who will sign us into law? I know you won't.